All right, ladies, Loose Wig 7 is about to burst onto your consciousness. Side 1.
John Dillinger, and hope he is still alive. Thanksgiving Day, November 28, 1986. Thanks for the wild turkey and the passenger pigeons, destined to be shit out through wholesome American guts. Thanks for a continent to despoil and poison. Thanks for Indians to provide a modicum of challenge and danger. Thanks for vast herds of bison to kill and skin, leaving the carcasses to rot. Thanks for bounties on wolves and coyotes. Thanks for the American dream. Vulgarize and falsify until the bare lies shine through. Thanks for the KKK, for nigger killing lawmen feeding their notches, for decent church going women with their mean, pinched, bitter, evil faces. Thanks for kill a queer for Christ stickers. Thanks for laboratory aids. Thanks for prohibition and the war against drugs. Thanks for a country where nobody is allowed to mind his own business. Thanks for a nation of thinkers. Yes, thanks for all the memories. All right, let's see your arms. You always were a headache, and you always were a bore. Thanks for the last and greatest betrayal of the last and greatest of human dreams.
It's saying that the self in each one of you is really at root one. Just in the same way that you have all over your body millions of nerve ends. Each one of those nerve ends is, as it were, a little eye, because all the senses are fundamentally one sense. Now imagine then every little nerve end is a little eye, and it gets its impression of the world, but it sends it all back into the central brain. Well, in a somewhat similar way, every person, every animal, every what the Hindus call sentient being, all those forms that we see may be looked upon as the eyes that look out of one central self. But going yet deeper, we find that it's somehow a necessity of thought that there be some sort of a something which is the common ground of all these universes, all these galaxies, and that ground is the self, as Hindus understand it, the Atman. Now that's quite a startling point of view. Because what it's saying is, you see, that you are basically the works.
Well,
so we're trapped. Trapped. Double trapped. Triple trapped. Anywhere we go, we find that we're trapped. And every kind of solution that someone comes up with is just another trap. But the political and economic philosophy of black nationalism, the economic philosophy of black nationalism, shows our people the importance of setting up these little stores and developing them and expanding them into larger operations, Woolworth didn't start out big like they are today. They started out with a dime store and expanded and expanded and expanded until today they're all over the country and all over the world, and they're getting some of everybody's money. Now, this is what you and I and General Motors, the same way, didn't start out like it is. It started out just a little rat race type operation, and it expanded and expanded until today it's where it is right now. And you and I have to make a start. And the best place to start is right in the community where we live. So our people not only have to be re-educated to the importance of supporting black business, but the black man himself has to be made aware of the importance of going into business. And once you and I go into business, we own and operate at least the businesses in our community, what we will be doing is developing a situation wherein we will actually be able to create employment for the people in the community. And once you can create some employment in the community where you live, it will eliminate the necessity of you and me having to act ignorantly and disgracefully boycotting and picketing some cracker someplace else trying to bang him for a job. Anytime you have to rely upon your enemy for a job, you're in bad shape. And he is your enemy. Anytime, you wouldn't be in this country if some enemy hadn't kidnapped you and brought you here. On the other hand, some of you think you came here on the Mayflower.
Fidel Castro senor to Batista, Fidel Castro senor, Fidel Castro make Batista surrender, Fidel Castro for democratic government, Fidel Castro, say no. No, Batista, run and surrender, Fidel Castro, say no. Castro made Batista surrender, Fidel Castro, say no. Fidel Castro say no. Batista, tell me why you surrender. Fidel Castro say no. Castro is a real woman, but Fidel Castro say no.
At times like this, it's important that we look back at the people and the events that got us to where we are today. For in the words of a very wise dead person, a nation that does not know its history is doomed to do poorly on the Scholastic Aptitude Test. Tragically, many Americans know very little about the history of their own country. We constantly see surveys that reveal this ignorance, especially among our high school students, 78% of whom in a recent nationwide multiple choice test identified Abraham Lincoln as a kind of lobster. What's the cause of this alarming situation? Partly, of course, it's that our young people are stupid. But another major part of the problem is the system used to teach history in our schools, a system known technically among professional educators as the boring method.
As much Taoist as Buddhist. then is a translation of the Sanskrit word jnana, pronounced chan in Chinese and then in Japanese, is unfortunately untranslatable in English. It designates a certain state of consciousness that is sometimes called meditation, but that won't do at all. Contemplation isn't really the point. And sometimes one-pointedness of mind. I would prefer to translate this word with the notion of total presence of mind. When we say a person is crazy, we often say they're not all there. Now go to the opposite of that and visualize a person who is completely there or who is completely here. Person who lives totally and absolutely now. That doesn't mean he's incapable of thinking about the past or the future, because thoughts about the past and about the future are included in the present. You have them now. But imagine the kind of person who is not distracted, who when he talks to you, really gives you his whole being. The Tao is a way of life. The word Tao means the way, the course of nature, the flow of things. And in order to understand this point of view, we have to make a very, very radical adjustment in our ordinary common sense. Because Zen and Taoism in common involve not a system of doctrine, not a set of beliefs as we ordinarily understand religion. They involve a transformation of your consciousness. That is to say, of the way in which you experience your own existence at every moment. One might say that the average individual, not only in the West but also in the East, has a feeling of himself as separate from his surroundings, from his from other people, and from the earth itself, and from the states and the stars and everything around the earth. He feels this in such a way that it's expressed in all the phrases of common speech. We talk about coming into the world. I came into this world. As a matter of fact, you didn't. You came out of it. Just in the same way as an apple comes out of an apple tree, as an expression of the apple tree.
Well,
and to make a long story short, and to tell you the whole point right at the beginning, the disciplines of Taoism and of Zen propose to change your consciousness in such a way that you will no longer feel that you are an isolated unit locked up inside a bag of skin, but that you will actually experience the fact that your real self, the real you, is everything that there is, but concentrated and expressing itself at the point called your physical organism. We as individual organisms, as what we call physical bodies, we come and go like leaves on a tree, but there's the tree. And you are the tree. In the saying of Jesus, I am the vine, you are the branches. But that I am, before Abraham was, I am, is the self, and is what the Hindus call the Brahman, and the Chinese call the Tao.
So as you can see, brothers and sisters, today, this afternoon, it's not our intention to discuss religion. We're going to forget religion. If we bring up religion, we'll be in an argument. And the best way to keep away from arguments and differences, as I said earlier, put your religion at home, in the closet. Keep it between you and your God. Because if it hasn't done anything more for you than it has, you need to forget it anyway.
Now, obviously, white and black are as different as different can be. When we say of someone that he's an awful liar and a con man, he say, why, he could prove it to you that black was white. But strangely enough, black is white in a certain sense, and white is black. If you take the copulating word is to mean implies, because black implies white, and white implies black, or positive implies negative, and negative implies positive, because you can't have the one without the other. It is only by contrast, when black and white are put together, that we know black as black and white as white. However, now, when I look at a small white circle or disk on a black background, or a small black disk on a white background, I once get this in my thought: which is positive and which is negative? Does black represent the negative because it's dark, like night? But when I look at the black dot on the white background, I think the black dot is the thing there, so that must be positive. It was put on. And therefore the white represents negative because it suggests nothing, no mark. Isn't this mysterious, you see, that both white and black can play the negative role? But then let's think of white as light, and it's playing the positive role. And when we think of black as the thing, the mark, then it's playing the positive role. See, both can play the negative and both can play the positive. But still, you can't have one without the other. But we are brought up, we are so brainwashed, we are so bamboozled, we are so hypnotized, that we don't know that. That's the whole trick that we've played on ourselves. We don't know that nothing is something. But it's important. So everything that we think of as nothing, space, empty space, death, sleep, dissolution, decay, any sort of weakness, anything that goes against structure, that is, against the thing, that we think is bad, 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 and we're trying to get a world where that side of things is rendered impotent. Nothingness must no longer constitute a threat to something. In other words, we want to play black and white, and if we'll call white the light and the positive, white must win. That's the game we're trying to play. Not realizing that there cannot be winning without losing. If white must win, black must lose. But if black loses, we can congratulate black for having helped white to win. Because unless black loses, white won't win. And so, in every sort of human enterprise, we are trying to have white without black.
Whether you are a Christian or a Muslim or a nationalist, we all have the same problem. They don't hang you because you're a Baptist, they hang you because you're black. They don't attack me because I'm a Muslim, they attack me because I'm black. They attack all of us for the same reason. All of us catch hell from the same enemy. We're all in the same bag, in the same boat. We suffer political oppression, economic exploitation, and social degradation. All of them from the same enemy. The government has failed us. You can't deny that. Anytime you live in the 20th century and you walking around here singing, "We shall overcome," the government has failed us. This is part of what's wrong with you. You do too much singing. Today it's time to stop singing and start swinging. You can't sing up on freedom, but you can swing up on some freedom. Cassius Clay can sing, but singing didn't help him to become the heavyweight champion of the world. Swinging helped him. So this government has failed us. The government itself has failed us. And the white liberals who have been posing as our friends have failed us. And once we see that all these other sources to which we've turned have failed, we stop turning to them and turn to ourselves. We need a self-help program, a do-it-yourself philosophy, a do-it-right-now philosophy. It's already too late philosophy. This is what you and I need to get with. And the only way we're going to solve our problem is with a self-help program. Before we can get a self-help program started, we have to have a self-help philosophy. Black nationalism is a self-help philosophy. What's so good about it, you can stay right in the church where you are and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can stay in any kind of civic organization that you belong to and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can be an atheist and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. This is a philosophy that eliminates the necessity for division and argument. Because if you're black, you should be thinking black. And if you're black and you're not thinking black at this late date, well, I'm sorry for you. Thank you.
hundreds of thousands of years ago, America was very different. There was no civilization, no roads, cities, no shopping malls, no Honda dealerships. The only inhabitants of America in those days were animals such as the deer and the antelope, who were engaged primarily in playing, and the buffalo or bison, who mainly roamed. But all this changed 20,000 years ago with the construction of the land bridge to Asia. Suddenly, the ancestors of the Indians and the Eskimos, clans who called themselves the ancestors of the Indians and the Eskimos, had a way to get to North America. There they formed tribes and spent the next several thousand years thinking up comical and hard-to-spell names for major rivers. Meanwhile, in Italy, Christopher Columbus was forming. As a youth, he had spent many hours gazing out to sea and thinking to himself, "Someday I'll be the cause of a holiday observed by millions of government workers." The fact that he thought in English was only one of the amazing things about the young Columbus. Another was his conviction that if he sailed all the way across the Atlantic, he would reach India. We now know, thanks to satellite photographs, that this makes him seem as stupid as a buffalo, although it sounded pretty good when Columbus explained it to the rulers of Spain, Ferdinand and his lovely wife Imelda, who agreed to finance the voyage by selling 6,000 pairs of her shoes.
Los Alamos Ranch School, where they later made the atom bomb and couldn't wait to drop it on the Yellow Peril. The boys are sitting on logs and rocks eating some sort of food. There's a stream at the end of a slope. The counselor was a southerner with a politician's look about him. He told us stories by the campfire, culled from the racist garbage of the insidious Sachs rumor. East is evil, west is good. Suddenly a badger erupts among the boys. Don't know why he did it, just playful, friendly, and inexperienced. Like the Aztec Indians who brought fruit down to the Spanish and got their hands cut off. So the counselor rushes for his saddlebag and gets out his 1911 Colt 45 auto and starts blasting at the badger, missing it with every shot at 6 feet. Finally, he puts his gun 3 inches from the badger's side and shoots. This time, the badger rolls down the slope into the stream. I can see the stricken animal, the sad, shrinking face, rolling down the slope, bleeding, dying. See an owl, you kill it, don't you? It might have bitten one of the boys. The badger just wanted to run up and play, and he gets shot with a 45 government issue. Contact that. Identify with that. Feel that and ask yourself whose life is worth more. The badger or this evil piece of white shit? As Brian Geisen said, man is a bad animal.
Thus the white men and the Native Americans were able, through the spirit of goodwill and compromise, to reach the first in what would become a long series of mutually beneficial agreements that enabled the two cultures to coexist peacefully for stretches of 20 and sometimes even 30 days, after which it was usually necessary to negotiate new agreements that would be even more mutual and beneficial, until ultimately the Native Americans were able to perceive the vast mutual benefits of living in rock-strewn sections of South Dakota. When Columbus returned to Spain with the news of his discovery, everybody became very excited and decided to have an age of exploration. Immediately, a great many bold adventurers, Magellan, Da Gama, De Soto, Chrysler, Picasso, and others,
each one brings the myth right out of himself. And what the analyst does is help you recognize it as the image carrier of your own affects, your own energies. The value of the psychiatrist is that he helps you to relate your own images to your own affects, to your own energy system. And the reason you're in trouble is that you don't realize this. Now, in the traditional societies, the images were supplied. The traditional mythology supplies the images, and you're supposed to have the affects. We're reversing that. The artist has an experience and he seeks the images through which to communicate it or render it. And he doesn't say to somebody, you have to get this message. Well, some of them do, but those are the ones we don't like to talk about. He exhibits his work, and if you like it, fine. If you don't, And so there's a sort of community of people who have slightly similar myths. But then we'll allow other people to have their own myths, each to have his own freedom. This is exactly the point, that it's an individual quest. No one ever had your dreams. You're in the dark forest every time you go to sleep. The only thing is that most of us leave our miracle down there and don't bring it up again.
By the 16th century, at approximately 4:30 p.m., England was experiencing a renaissance. This took the form of Ben Jonson and, of course, William Shakespeare, the immortal Barge of Avon. This golden age in England was called the Elizabethan era, after the Queen, Elizabeth Ann era, who was known as the Virgin Queen because it was not considered a tremendously smart move to call her the really ugly queen.
For all mankind.
Jung's concept is that the dream, the unconscious, complements the conscious situation. And where the conscious situation is radically wrong, the dream offers a correction. So that the first thing the doctor has to do is find what the person's situation is to which the dream is talking, and then ask the person to associate with the object in pure consciousness, not free association, but what do you think of in relation to this image? When, however, a truly mythological image appears in the dream with which the person can have no personal associations, then you've hit another level of the unconscious, what he calls the collective unconscious. And that part of the dream can be interpreted tentatively, you know, or approximately, by comparative mythological studies. What he calls the amplification of the dream imagery by comparative studies. His notion is not that the dream is trying to hide something from you, as in the Freudian view, but the dream is trying to reveal something to you through a language, through a picture language that you don't know how to read. Well, then, how do you read the language? Well, how would you break any cryptic script? The philological method of comparison. You know, when you receive a letter in a handwriting that you can't quite read and there's a word you can't decipher, you go back to see if there are any other letters that look like this one. Oh, yes, that's a T. Oh, that's the way she's making her O's now. And all that kind of thing. So you can put the word together. And so it is with the images in dreams. If they are from the personal recollections, from the personal unconscious, the individual dreaming will have associations, and by amplifying these, you can interpret the dream. But if it hits the collective level, the only way to interpret it is by mythological comparisons, because there what is talking is the biological inheritance. The unconscious is not only a reservoir of rejected personal experiences, it is also a source from the inherited impulses of the body. Every organ of the body has its impulse, and they're all pushing from within. And in that sense, you share your mythology with everyone else. These are the archetypes.
And thus it was that in some specific year, the Puritans, taking with them little more than stupid hats and an unwavering faith in Providence, a city in Rhode Island that, unbeknownst to the Puritans, had not been founded yet, set sail across the dark and treacherous North Atlantic in the Mayflower, a cramped, frail ship of Panamanian registry. When the Puritans landed, they found themselves in a harsh and desolate world, and they probably would have starved to death if not for the help of a friendly local Native American named Squanto. Squanto looked at the Puritans barging around the wilderness with their hats and their comical Puritan muskets shaped like trombones at the end, and he took pity on them. "Look," he said, because fortunately he also spoke English, "what you need to do is plant some corn." And so they did, and after a couple of months it grew and ripened, and the Puritans, who by this time were hungrier than ever, boiled it and ate it with butter and a little salt. "Next time you should try shucking it first," advised Squanto. Eventually, as you would expect, a year went by. The Puritans decided that all things considered, it had been a pretty good year, except for the fact that the vast majority of them were at that point dead. So they decided to have the first traditional Thanksgiving. They invited Squanto over to join them in eating a turkey. "Next time," advised the ever-helpful Squanto, "try cooking it first." After which they watched the Lions-Bears game. Then the Puritans told Squanto they were very grateful for all he had done, but that frankly they would not be needing him anymore, so he and his tribe should go find some other area to be natives of.
The Buddha set forth his doctrine in the form of four noble truths. The first truth is concerned with the problematic word dukkha, loosely translatable as suffering, which designates the great disease of the world, for which the Buddha's method, dharma, is the cure. This, however, cannot be compressed into the sweeping assertion that life is suffering. The point is rather that life as we usually live it is suffering, or more exactly, is bedeviled by the peculiar frustration which comes from attempting the impossible. Perhaps then, Frustration is the best equivalent of dukkha. The second noble truth relates to the cause of frustration, which is said to be trishna, clinging or grasping, based on avidya, which is ignorance or unconsciousness. Now, avidya is the formal opposite of awakening. It is the state of the mind when hypnotized or spellbound by maya, so that it mistakes the abstract world of things and events for the concrete world of reality. At a still deeper level, it is the lack of self-knowledge, lack of the realization that all grasping turns out to be the futile effort to grasp oneself, or rather, to make life catch hold of itself. The third noble truth is concerned with the ending of self-frustration, of grasping, and of the whole viciously circular pattern of karma which generates the round. The ending of karma is called nirvana. Nirvana could be described as despiration. It is the act of one who has seen the futility of trying to hold his breath or life, prana, indefinitely, since to hold the breath is to lose it. Thus, nirvana is the equivalent of moksha, release or liberation. Nirvana is the way of life which ensues when clutching at life has come to an end. To attain nirvana is also to attain Buddhahood, awakening. But this is not attainment in any ordinary sense, because no acquisition and no motivation are involved. It is impossible to desire nirvana, or to intend to reach it, for anything desirable or conceivable as an object of action is, by definition, not nirvana. Nirvana can only arise unintentionally, spontaneously, when the impossibility of self-grasping has been thoroughly perceived. The fourth noble truth describes the eightfold path of the Buddha's Dharma, that is, the method or doctrine whereby self-frustration is brought to an end. The first two sections have to do with thought, the following four have to do with action, and the final two to do with contemplation or awareness. The four sections dealing with action are often misunderstood because they have a deceptive similarity to a system of morals. Buddhism does not share the Western view that there is a moral law enjoined by God or by nature, which it is one's duty to obey. The Buddha's precepts of conduct, abstinence from taking life, taking what is not given, exploitation of the passions, lying and intoxication, are voluntarily assumed rules of expedience, the intent of which is to remove the hindrances to clarity, to awareness. Failure to observe the precepts produces bad karma, not because karma is a law or moral retribution, but because all motivated and purposeful actions, whether conventionally good or bad, are karma insofar as they are directed to the grasping of life. Generally speaking, the conventionally bad actions are rather more grasping than the good. But the higher stages of Buddhist practice are as much concerned with disentanglement from good karma as from bad. Thus, complete action is ultimately free, uncontrived, or spontaneous action, in exactly the same sense as the Taoist Wu Wei.
This means not to force things. That's the best English translation I've come to. It's sometimes translated not doing, no artificiality, no interference. But our word forcing, as when a forced laugh, forcing a lock, forced behavior, forced kindness, forced love, in that sense, forcing. Don't force it. So it means action in accordance with the character of the moment and of the circumstances in which you're acting. You see, you can't not interfere with the world. Everything you do interferes with your environment. To know things is to change them. You cannot not interfere. So the idea is to learn how to interfere skillfully. That's the meaning of Wu Wei.
Once you change your philosophy, you change your thought pattern. Once you change your thought pattern, you change your attitude. Once you change your attitude, it changes your behavior pattern. And then you go on into some action. As long as you got a sit-down philosophy, you'll have a sit-down thought pattern. And as long as you think that old sit-down thought, you'll be in some kind of sit-down action. They'll have you sitting in everywhere.
it's not so good to refer to what you're going to do as a sit-in. That right there castrates you. Right there it brings you down. What goes with it? What, think of the image of someone sitting. An old woman can sit. An old man can sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting to back that up.
Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Wherefore, if God so clothed the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? Therefore, take no thought, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? Wherewithal shall we be clothed? But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Take therefore no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof.
Once you change your philosophy, you change your thought pattern. Once you change your thought pattern, you change your attitude. Once you change your attitude, it changes your behavior pattern. And then you go on into some action.
Shortly before 500, as the dates now check out, another Indian came to China whose name was Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma was the person who touched off Zen as a specific movement. Bodhidharma had a pupil by the name of Eka. The story is that when Eka came to Bodhidharma, Bodhidharma refused to accept him as a student. All Zen masters do this. They reject you. And this stimulates you, you see, to come back stronger. If you're going to learn at all. And Eka came back stronger and stronger and stronger, and Bodhidharma resisted him stronger and stronger, and finally he cut off his left arm and presented it to Bodhidharma. He said, look, here's my left arm given to you as a token that nothing in the world matters to me except to find out what you're all about. All right, he said, what do you want to know? Eka said, I have no peace of mind. Please pacify my mind. In Chinese, mind is this word pronounced shin. And shin is here. Shin is the heart mind. It's the psychic center. And so Bodhidharma said, bring out your shin here before me and I will pacify it. Eka said, when I look for it, I can't find it. Bodhidharma said, then it's pacified. And Eka immediately understood what all the thing was about. That's the experience called Satori in Japanese, Wu in Chinese, Mandarin, and in the Cantonese dialect, it's just what we call in our modern psychological jargon the aha phenomenon. The aha phenomenon. Aha! Now I see.
Why does it look like it might be the year of the ballot or the bullet? Because Negroes have listened to the trickery and the lies and the false promises of the white man now for too long. And they're fed up. They've become disenchanted. They've become disillusioned. They've become dissatisfied. And all...